Hey, if you're enjoying this show, consider supporting us on our Patreon. You can get cool perks like access to these episodes a week before they go public, and you can pick an album for us to review. Any support is greatly appreciated, so if you feel inclined, go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.
You're listening to Polyphonic Press, a podcast for music lovers. Join your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke, as they take a deep dive into a classic album and analyze it track by track.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
And basically, if you don't know how the show works, we have no idea what album we're going to listen to this week. We review classic albums, but we don't know what album we listen to when we start recording. So we have a program here to help us decide what album we're going to listen to. So let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. And the album we're going to be listening to is Lemonheads, It's a Shame About Ray. I have no idea what any of that is, so let's find out.
I think the name Lemonheads may have crossed my paths once or twice, but it's nothing I know anything about.
I think so. They're like they're an alternative band that were sort of like in the underground. I think they were like an influence on like Nirvana. Mm. And like they're like an 80s punk band, I think.
Okay.
I think.
Well, we'll find out. I was guessing maybe 90s.
Yeah. Well, I think they maybe started in the 80s, but they went into the 90s.
Okay. Well, we'll see.
I think they were one of those bands that they started in the underground and weren't popular until the 90s, but they were around in the 80s.
Gotcha.
Okay. So let's find out about the Lemonheads. Lemonheads are an American alternative rock band formed in Boston, Massachusetts in 1986. Evan Dando and Ben Daly and Jesse Peretz. So I think maybe they're a trio. After their initial punk influence releases and tours as an independent college rock band in the late 1980s, the Lemonheads' popularity with a mass audience grew in 1992 with the major label album It's a Shame About Ray, which is the album we're going to be listening to.
Gotcha.
So this album is their breakthrough album, their major label debut. As
What year was that?
92.
Okay. Well, there you go.
It was produced by the Robb brothers, Bruce, Robb, and three producers, Bruce, Robb, D, and Joe. This was followed by a cover of Simon and Garfunkel's Mrs. Robinson. I think I might have heard that cover of the Simon and Garfunkel song. I'm not sure, but I think I might have heard that.
We'll find out.
It might have been on a movie soundtrack somewhere.
Yeah, that's all right.
So, what about the album? Let's go to the album and find out. Okay, It's a Shame About Ray is the fifth album by American alternative rock band The Lemonheads, released on June 2nd, 1992. The album was produced by the Robb brothers. At the time of principal recording, the band consisted of Evan Dando, Juliana Hatfield on Evan Dando, lead vocals and guitar, Juliana Hatfield, bass and backing vocals, and David Ryan on drums. Though not originally on the album, the band's cover of Simon and Garfunkel's Mrs. Robinson was added to the album in later pressings after it had become a major worldwide radio hit, and it features a later lineup of the band with Nick Dalton on bass. Cool. So I think what we'll do is because it was sort of part of the release, we will include the cover of Mrs. Robinson.
Yeah.
Okay. On this episode. So
kind of like a bonus track or something.
Yeah. Okay. So the, there's short songs on here. So the first song is called Rock and Stroll. So here we go. Okay, wow. First of all, I really, really, really like that.
Okay.
One of the first, I think it's, first of all, I think it's too short. I think it could have gone on a little longer. It's only a minute and 46 seconds. I don't know. There's something about it that I really like. One of the things that I like about it is, the chords in the verse were descending and the vocal melody was kind of doing the opposite. And there were, it's like the chords were descending and the vocal was ascending. It was kind of creating this juxtaposition and this counterpoint. I thought that was really, really cool.
Yeah, actually I did notice that. That's pretty cool. I have noticed that a lot of music from this era, I don't know, it seems to be the sound of it sounds a little generic to me. And I'm it's hard to pinpoint what it is, but it's like the overall sound of the guitars and everything just had lacks a bit of character.
Yeah. Well, I think this was maybe because of it's the kind of the start of the loudness war, and things were starting to get like over compressed.
Okay.
That might have something to do with it. Cause yeah, the guitars, like there weren't a lot of dynamics in the song. It was just kind of like, and then it was over.
Yeah. Which I mean, that I don't necessarily hate. It's just, it's like one of my favorite things is when I like hear a guitar part, I like being able to sort of pick out, I like a unique guitar tone. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't pick out anything like that. It was just a generic guitar strum sound, and I can't even tell what they were using or anything like that. It was just seemed, and it's not everything. It's just most of the production just sort of came off that way. It wasn't bad. It just seemed a little lacking of color or something.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that. Maybe the producers weren't putting as much effort as they could have in this.
Into the, well, having, yeah, something with a little more character.
I wonder.
That's just
wonder,
the first track.
Yeah, yeah, we'll that's true. I wonder if maybe that's, I wonder if their earlier stuff is more interesting.
I don't
in
know.
In that regard, because maybe this is, that's maybe the, this is their major label debut, and maybe it's the record company kind of meddling maybe. With things.
Maybe. Who knows?
You know. I don't know. That's, I can see what you, where you're coming from, that it does have that, well, I mean, this is 92, so it's like Nirvana was like at the peak of their, of their popularity. I'm sure every record company was trying to,
but they've got to
capture that,
but they've got like different tones and textures and things that are very uniquely them.
Right.
Yeah, this was very, I don't know, not a bad song. It was, you know, the song itself was actually pretty good. It was, you know, it just, I don't know, something just was missing in the overall thing for me.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. Well, I'm curious about the next song. Let's hear that one. It's called Confetti. Yeah, I can see what you're saying about the production.
Yeah, there was a little more character in that one, but it still seemed, it needs to be taken a little bit further.
It's a shame because I think the band is playing really well.
Absolutely. And
I thought that was an interesting song. They're an American band, but that song, they sounded really British on that one.
And some of that, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the guitar solo I thought could have been brought up a little bit in the mix.
Yeah, for sure. It seemed a little quiet, but that was, you know, that's certainly not the worst thing at all.
No,
it wasn't exactly like hidden or anything like that.
No,
which is, otherwise, I mean, I like that track a little bit more. It had sort of like a jangle pop sort of thing going to it.
Yeah.
But again, the character was a little bit buried in that, but it was starting to emerge a little bit.
Yeah.
So But yeah, again, we're only two tracks in, so.
Yeah. I like to, I know I've said this before, but, I always like it when, like an acoustic and electric guitar are playing, side by side like that. I always like that sound. And, so I like that. And yeah, yeah, you're like, I think, yeah, I think I like this song better than the opening track, and it is because of the sort of the more jangly kind of thing they're going for on this one. Yeah, I'm interested to hear the rest of the album.
Yeah,
to see if it holds up or not. So, let's get into the next song, which is the title track. It's A Shame About Ray. Okay, a couple things. I liked the chord changes in the intro, and I liked the way the bass was playing against it, creating a little bit of dissonance there. I thought that was really well done. I think so far this is my favorite song of the three that we've heard. But the guitars sound the same as the other songs. The drums, I don't think the drums sound on this fits the style of music.
The drums do seem to be a little bit, again, a little bit buried in the mix. Maybe I just like it when things sort of stand out more on their own.
Yeah.
And I like a little bit of that shimmer in a guitar tone or something like that, or a honk or something that can really like,
but I will say I think this guitar tone fits this song better because it is in a minor key and it's a bit of a more melancholy sound.
That guitar tone
fits this song.
It's got that melancholy, almost like a summer breezy sound to it, and that acoustic playing with the electric, especially done in this way, really does fit that song.
Yeah.
But I like it when something will stand out.
Well, I think the problem with the drums is it has too much reverb on them.
There's a little bit, yeah.
And I think because I don't know, whenever drums have too much reverb. You know, I know this is 1992, so it's the 80s are still, you know, pretty close, and some of the trends from the 80s are still bleeding over. But I think that drum sound, you know, whether you like it or not, that drum sound maybe fits with glam metal, like Poison and that kind of thing. I don't think it really works in this context in a band like this. I think it would have been better off with a more natural sounding drums.
Yeah,
and you're right, if they were a little more present and, you know, had a little more character to them.
I think it's partly because, you know, the drums sound sort of a little too airy, and then the guitar sound too airy, and then the bass is generally all right, although again it's down in the mix and it doesn't seem to do anything to combat that overall airiness. You need something that sort of juxtaposes with, you know, the other character. You need something, you don't want it to necessarily fight it, but something's got to give it a character.
Balance it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the vocals, I think, I don't know. I don't know about the, because I think maybe the vocals, the way that they're mixed, maybe do like that sort of distant sort of sound to the vocals, maybe because of the music and it is like a more somber thing, maybe that does work with this. I don't know if it would necessarily work with every song.
Right.
I don't know. Yeah. I think they could have taken another pass at it, and you know, they may have made these choices deliberately, and we're just, you know, it's just a disagreement. But you know, it sounds like maybe they're, you know, the producers are still pretty young and inexperienced. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know the ages of these guys.
Yeah.
I know the band's been around. What you said, this is their fifth album, but this is their first
album.
But yeah, it's the first one that really made any waves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I tend to do this a lot, but it, you know, if I were producing it, I would make some different choices, I think.
Yeah. But it's like, I'm trying to think of, like, this is up against things like, oh, and this is a very Canadian perspective. I'm thinking of like the Tragically Hip's first album or something like that. Second album came out in 89. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of how everything had this punch to it, and the guitars and the bass and the drums and everything. It still sounded of its period, but it had a presence, and there's so much character to it, and nothing sounded like it was trying to hide something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, another album that came out closer to this one, yeah, is the Black Crowes second,
yes,
album. And that album, you know, does have a lot of character in the, yes, guitar tone, even though I think the difference is that album was mostly recorded live off the floor, and
sometimes that makes a difference, but I think even if they didn't do it live off the floor, they just make sort of different, just it's I don't know, too airy to me. I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. It's too it's like, it's almost like there's a distance between the listener and the music.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the Southern Harmony, it's, everything is more clear and upfront, and, you know, right, it's like you're right in front of the band listening to it.
And yet it can still convey a sense of openness, like open fields or something like that.
Yeah.
You still get that out of some parts of the song, but it feels like that field is more present to you. You're not, right, like watching it from, I don't know, a void and seeing this open field as like the closest thing. I don't know. It's a little bit, I don't know what the right word is. You almost feel a little bit disconnected.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's like you're not, and the thing is, it's a shame because the thing is, like, these songs call, they want to be connected with.
Yeah.
And it's like there's like you're reaching for the music, and there's like this barrier between you and the music, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of feel, yeah. And my another part of my point is that this band is not the only, not the only band that committed this sin at this period. There seemed to be a lot of bands that had this sort of sound to it. And yeah, it was very hard. It's just like, they're playing stuff that I should like. Why am I having a hard time connecting with this?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next track.
Yeah.
The next one is called Rudderless. So. Cool.
Yeah. That one wasn't bad.
Yeah.
I kind of liked some of the, they were definitely, you could hear a little bit more risks being taken in the studio for that one. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And I think when they're trying to say that it's like a ship without a rudder, I think they mean a barge.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So I was actually just reading about the producer, and the producer is named Bruce Robb, and he was in a band in the 60s called The Robbs.
Okay, I've heard of them. Believe it or not.
Yeah, well, I believe it. He He apparently opened a studio in California called Cherokee Studios, which is actually pretty famous. I've heard of Cherokee Studios. Mm-hmm. And he's produced people like Mos Def, Macy Gray, Henry Rollins, Steve Vai, Lemonheads, John Mellencamp, Steve Cropper, Ringo Starr, Etta James, Art Garfunkel, Rod Stewart, Del Shannon, and Wilson Pickett, amongst others.
That's so, a pretty good lineup.
So now I don't feel so bad criticizing him.
just he wasn't choices. A young guy.
No, so it's just... choices he's making that I'm disagreeing with.
Yes.
You know, and the thing is, obviously he, I think the downfall of this album, if there is any, is that it's a product of its time. Mm. And I get it. I mean, you know, when you're making an album in a studio, it's hard to avoid trends of the current time. Even if you're not conscious of it, you're still gonna, you know, do stuff that is you know, popular at the moment.
Yeah, it'll leak through. Even when there's a pretty good example of what I'm thinking of. Okay, think of like the 60s garage revival of the 80s. Mm-hmm. These are bands are all trying to recreate that sound from the 60s, yet it still comes off sounding a bit like the mid 80s.
Yeah.
At least their particular brand of the mid 80s. Mm-hmm. Early mid 80s, whatever, you know. And that's not a problem. I still love that stuff, but you can definitely tell it's of a different period.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's hard to get away from, you know.
Sometimes it's not necessarily a bad thing. It will stay, the period will put its stamp on your stuff regardless, unless you're like meticulous about trying to get every ounce of, you know, modern influence out of your stuff as humanly possible.
Yeah,
I guess it's not impossible, but it's almost impossible.
Well, I remember getting the soundtrack to Almost Famous.
Right.
And the songs that were recorded for the band for that movie were
Fever Dog, yeah.
And
what was the band called?
Stillwater.
Stillwater, that's right.
And I remember the first time, because in the movie you don't really notice it, but I remember hearing the recordings for the first time and thinking, this doesn't sound like the 70s.
It sounds a bit like the 70s, but yes, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
It sounded more like the 70s than, say, The Wonders did sound like the 60s.
Yeah.
Which, again, it was actually a decent song. After watching the movie, you get kind of sick of the song because it's being played constantly through it.
Yeah.
But I would hear it on the radio every once in a while. I was like, oh, that's a neat sort of 60s pop sounding song. I mean, clearly it doesn't sound like it was recorded in the 60s, but, you know... The period of which it is actually from is more present than in a lot of cases the period in which it is trying to be from.
Yeah, but you can still hear the what they're trying to go for as well.
Of course.
But
oh yeah, I mean, when I hear The Wonder, I didn't know when I first heard it, I didn't know it was supposed to be a it was from a movie. I had no idea. I just heard basically jangle pop. It sounded like any one of those other jangle pop bands from the 80s or 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually a better one. Probably because they were trying to be more 60s.
Right. They were deliberately trying to make it sound like it was recorded in the 60s. Yeah.
Yes. Which they didn't quite do.
They didn't quite as we were talking about. No, exactly. Yeah. Because they recorded on equipment from the 90s.
Exactly.
yeah. Okay. So the next song is an interesting title. It's called My Drug Buddy. So here we go. So that was a great song. I probably would have mixed it totally different.
Yeah. I find this one didn't sound so out of place. Or at least the production didn't sound so out of place for me on this one. It sounded like this song almost could have been exactly as it was on an album full of other songs, of everything else had what I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
To beat a dead horse.
Well, what I would do differently is I would have turned the drums down in the mix because okay. I thought they were too high, too present. Because this is a slower ballad kind of song.
Yeah, I might have given them a more dry drum sound. Even if I didn't turn them down, they'd be drier.
And I knew that they were there, and I could kind of hear them. The acoustic guitars, I would have brought them up a little more.
Hmm. More presence for, I can hear that.
Yeah.
Because
I think this song, I like the organ. I would have kept
the organ
that
was
in,
great. Yeah.
But I would have blended it more with the guitars. And sort of created sort of a texture or like a soundscape blending the organ with the guitars. I would have turned the drums down a little bit and brought the bass up a little bit more. Because I think the drums in that one kind of overpowered everything else.
Maybe. I didn't find them so overpowering. I think they were a little bit louder than everything else, but because of the reverb on it, like that seems to be the decision that they took to take it down from being overpowering. Mm-hmm. Whereas I would have rather had more presence. Again, we're just disagreeing with the way they mix this.
Yeah. And I mean, there's probably, fans going, oh, they're nitpicking. Well, we kind of are, but that's our
job. We are nitpicking. This is true. Yeah. This is kind of, but whereas a lot of stuff, like I'm perfectly happy to leave it alone. Mm-hmm. And it won't bother me. And actually this song doesn't bother me nearly as much as, I don't know, that first one just kind of hit me weird. And a couple, it's becoming less and less of a problem, though I'm still very aware of that sound, and it's kind of hard to get out of my head. Here's another band that I thought sort of does, I understand the sort of atmosphere they're trying to get with this album, but there's other bands that get the same sort of atmosphere much more effectively without making their stuff sound so dead or something.
Right.
And I'm thinking another Canadian example, Blue Rodeo.
Mm-hmm.
They're masters at it.
Yeah.
And we were talking about, for pity's sakes, the Tragically Hip. They certainly did it multiple times. And we were talking about the Black Crows. They certainly did it quite a few times throughout their career, depending on what they're doing. Southern Harmony is a perfect example of how they would go about that sort of thing. But everything still had a presence. Everything still had this unique sort of tonal quality to it. You could pick things out. It didn't just seem like this wash.
Mm-hmm.
It just, everything had these characters. Like it's like when you do like almost in painting and stuff like that. When I was in design, like my professor was telling me how basically every color contains every other color, and you can make certain colors, but you can bring out tonalities of other colors in it if you want. And you sometimes will see like sketches that people will do and you wonder why part of their face is blue or red or anything. But when you look at the overall whole, you sort of get the proper shading and stuff like that. Even if it's a little bit different, that's sort of like the difference between like, let's say the production quality of this, where they're painting everything as you would surface level perceive it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, the Black Blue Rodeo or the Black Crows come in and they'll do the same image, but they'll bring out all these other colors and tones and shadows and highlights and stuff like that in places. And it just seems a little bit more alive. And it just seems a little bit more real, and there's a lot more, it's a lot moodier. So, that just seems to be the way I can sort of compare. I'm still beating that dead horse. Womp, 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 womp.
Yeah.
Hey, no. Are you alive? Nay.
But no, I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, it's... There was, I think it was on the documentary on the making of Damn the Torpedoes, where Mike Campbell was talking about, well, you can make an album all on one guitar and get a few variations on the tone.
That's but the, if what you, he's talking about is 12 string. Yep.
Yeah. But if you choose, okay, well, and just think about for a second, okay, well, what does this song call for? Does it need a Gibson, like humbucker tone? Does it need like a single coil, like a Fender or something in between, like a Gretsch? You know, what would make this song, you know, just elevate the song to the next level? And it sounds like this album, these producers aren't really having those discussions. It just seems like, well, you know, we'll just, you know, bring your guitar and we'll set it up and we'll record, which, I mean, it's cool if you're going for that, you know, raw sort of unpolished sound, that's cool. But it sounds like because the drums are mixed the way they are, and it sounds like they're, you know, putting a lot of thought into this. It doesn't sound unpolished. It just kind of, you know, it doesn't, you know what I mean? Like it just sounds like they should be having those discussions on, you know, what tones or what, you know, how we can mix this differently or, you know, what guitar, maybe change out an amp or something. But it just seems like they're not having those conversations about what they need to do.
Yeah. And I'd also like to put another point in. And this sort of alludes to that, the Let It Be documentary, which I just watched. Whereas there's other ways to achieve that, and you don't necessarily have to switch out instruments. And when you're watching the Beatles, say, record Let It Be, they basically showed up with, basically, they picked their favorite instrument, and that's almost all they use throughout the whole thing, with a few exceptions. But for the most part, that's, you know, George has got his, the Red Les Paul, Paul's got his Hofner bass, much to the annoyance of Glyn Johns. and Ringo's got the drum kit, and John's got his Casino.
Yeah.
But they can get all these different sort of... every song doesn't sound like it came out of exactly the same template or anything like that. The instruments they're using are largely exactly the same, but there's ways to... I mean, there's tone knobs and things like that, but there's also Glyn Johns is a master of taking whatever is being thrown at him, and he can move it around and shape it to the way it needs to be. And nothing comes out sounding like it's exactly the same as the last thing. And nothing sounds like it's a flat wash. You're getting those colors. You're getting those textures.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly right.
Yeah.
I think what I would have liked to have heard is have them sort of, you know, take that extra step and cause I, like I said, there, so far there isn't a bad song here.
No,
the songs themselves are great. I've not been disappointed with the actual songs, and I think they deserve, more attention to the production and a little more time and a little more thought in, well, you know, what effects or what, tones or what, you know, how we can mix it, you know, what would make this song really come out? Maybe like, I obviously we weren't in the studio when they were recording. So I don't really know much about the producer or this band. I mean, this is like the first time that I'm sure I've heard of the Lemonheads before, but I didn't really know anything about them.
Right.
So, but, I don't know. I mean, obviously they weren't disappointed with the way the album came out, because Bruce Rupp produced the next album as well.
Okay.
But I don't know. Maybe I don't know if the record company assigned the producer or what happened.
And again, I'm thinking it was probably more than accepted at the time. Well, obviously it's on this list. We're one of these lists thrown into our mix of lists. It hit differently at the time than it does now. And most people remember it. It's a piece of nostalgia for them now.
Yeah.
And we've talked about that before.
Yeah. I just think part of the frustration that I'm having is these songs are really good.
Right.
And they deserve better.
Yes.
They deserve more attention. Mm-hmm. Than, you know, just mixing them all the same.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think that's a pretty good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to get my hands on the masters or the board and just start moving around some switches and taking out some reverb or adding or whatever.
Yeah.
Just and creating my own remaster of it.
But then you run the risk of doing what Phil Spector did to Let It Be.
Of course. Yeah, but he basically brought in an orchestra. That was a little bit of an egregious process. He got no permission to do that. Yeah. But this is Phil Spector we're talking about.
Yeah. Phil Spector didn't get permission to do anything.
No.
All right. Well, we're about halfway through the album. Let's get to the next one. It's called The Turnpike Down. That was a good song.
Yeah, there was some neat stuff going on in that.
Yeah. The vocals, I think, could have been a little higher, but other than that, I mean, it has the same things going on that we've already talked about, so I don't want to keep going on about
whack.
Yeah. But the song I think was really good.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting when the guitars were, you know, in sort of like that clean tone playing along with the acoustics, and then it would gradually get a little bit dirtier in that one part. I thought that was sort of a neat transition.
Yeah, that was like, really cool.
They're full of all these ideas. I just wish somebody else had given a chance, whatever. Anyway,
yeah,
whack,
I know.
Whack, whack, whack. I
know. Other than that, I don't really have anything more to say that hasn't already been said.
Pretty much.
So let's move on to the next one. The next song is called Bit Part. See, I think that's one of the few songs where the production was actually kind of working for it.
Mm. It was a very bit part indeed. It's only a minute and 50 seconds or so.
Yeah. But I think, you know, that sort of, because of the content of the lyrics, I think that distance kind of works for it, you know?
Yeah. It starts off with a screaming fit. That's a little bit different. There is definitely a juxtaposition between the sound, the overall sound, and of course, then that.
Yeah.
It might be a little bit jarring if you weren't expecting it. I don't think we were expecting it.
I wasn't expecting it. Yeah. I think, you know, I think this song actually could have been a bit longer.
But I don't know. I think the length sort of fits its...
Yeah, that's true.
It's bit part, the content. You
know, yeah, exactly.
It's message.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with it.
Yeah. I like that song. I don't really have anything else to add about it.
Yeah. Do this. That just usually means we need to move on to the next one.
Yeah.
I mean, that was, what song was that? Seven.
Seven.
I guess we're doing 13?
13, yeah.
Okay.
So the next one is called Allison's Starting to Happen. Well, let's hope so.
That's more like it.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
That's like is this is way more alive going on in that one. It sounded like somebody else came in that day.
Yeah. That yeah. No, I mean there's a few things I wanted to say. I liked the breakdown with the cowbell and the guitars, the rhythm that they were kind of creating together was really cool. And there was a lot more going on with that song than there has been up until this point. Mm-hmm. So far, I think that's my favorite song.
Yeah, me too, by far. That's a whopping improvement.
Yeah.
More of that, please.
Yeah.
That was just a great song too. I love some of the stuff they did in that. I mean, they were doing all those great ideas. Well, you know, great ideas, much like what you were hearing in the rest of this album, but it was just presented a little bit better. It came out, it was just way more alive. I don't know. It just sounded like night and day.
Yeah. It sounded like everything was, I think
the sun came out.
Yeah. Well, I think the problem so far is, you know, my criticisms so far have been, well, this needs to be a little louder or this needs to be brought down.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I'm thinking, wow, everything is balanced. There's, I can hear everything that I need to hear. And, you know, this is just the way it's supposed to sound.
Yeah, but it didn't sound like this gray wash.
Exactly.
There was things that you could pick out that actually it stimulated your brain.
Yeah.
Throughout most of this album, I'm having a hard time getting my brain stimulated. It sounds very, again, there's just this gray wash.
Boring.
It's kind of boring, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not because the songs are bad. It's
no.
because production just sounds dead to me.
Mm-hmm.
This song is, I want to hear more of that. I hope there's more of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I totally agree. The next song is actually one that I'm curious to hear because, it has a slide guitar and the person playing the slide guitar is Jeff Baxter from, he was in Steely Dan and the Doobie Brothers.
Yeah. He did a lot of studio stuff too.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's really good.
So I'm very curious to hear that. So, the next song is called Hannah and Gabby. Are they doing this on purpose? Are they making the production choices early in the album and then slowly bringing everything into focus? Because that one was pretty good too.
That one was a really good one. And it was partly, I mean, again, it was still that overall sound, but because Jeff Baxter was there with the slide guitar, it gave you that thing that sort of, there was that sharp pit part that was stimulating. It poked through.
It gave
you something to focus on.
Putting the seasoning on the top of the dish.
Exactly.
It's like it's that thing that, yeah.
Your meat and potatoes is fine, but it's nice to season it once in a while.
Maybe all this album needs is a little bit of like, I don't know, like percussion, like a shaker or a tambourine or something to just kind of
bring everything
into focus.
I mean, the Allison Starting to Happen had that cowbell going through.
Yeah, and that maybe that's really why. Helped.
It's partly it, but there was a lot of other things going on that one. Man, that song, that was a decent song.
Yeah,
this last one, it had that sort of a country-ish flavor to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it worked pretty well. You just need more. You need like something like that glassy, something that pokes through or you know, when I talk about like a honk, like a Les Paul has like that honky sound or 12 string Rickenbacker's got that chimey jangly, but these are like very bright tones. They come out, they're very clear. They've got very definitive, like the equivalent of a color.
Yeah.
Like for the ears.
Yeah. The challenge is you don't want anything that's going to take away from the vocals.
Of course. But you need something to make it alive.
Yeah, you need something that's going to stand out and set it apart from the other instruments. Because look, it's you know, they're like my favorite album, Damn the Torpedoes. It has that very distinct drum sound,
mm-hmm.
and pretty much every song on the album has that drum sound. But and that's okay, as long and so that's the foundation, but. The guitar tones on everything else are the variables, and
right.
You know, it's not the same every time. So I think, and they do have like, you know, different things going on with it. I'm picking that album because that's the one I'm most familiar with, but,
right. No, it's a good reference.
Yeah. So that production kind of works for that. It has like there's percussion, like there's shakers on pretty much every song, just to kind of tie it all together and just to even if you don't notice it, even if the listener doesn't notice that it's there, it's a subconscious thing. It's doing something to move the track along. Mm. And I think a lot of these songs need something like that.
Yeah.
Even if nothing else has changed, even if the production stays the same.
Yeah. I think it just needs another element to get your ears interested.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah,
exactly.
So I think the percussion on the last song and I think it's a pedal steel guitar he's playing.
Yeah, it's a pedal steel for sure. Maybe it's a lap steel, but I think it's a pedal steel.
Yeah. So the addition of those things are kind of making me realize that that's what's missing.
Yeah.
It's just that extra seasoning on top to make the flavor come out, or, you know, or the colors to pop, or whatever, you know, analogy you want to use. It's just that thing on top that just separates everything, separates the song and gives it something distinct. And, yeah, I think that's what's missing from the other songs.
I'm thinking back again to the Black Crowes, and you're thinking, and as popular as that first album was, there was definitely an extra element when Eddie Harsh joined the band and he added that organ.
Yeah.
And the Black Crowes suddenly had like the sound.
Yeah.
Which is
even if the organ wasn't, because most of their stuff was very guitar driven.
Oh, it was. And
even if the organ wasn't, you know, as present in the mix, it was still there, and it was still like, even if you're not aware of it, it's still adding this texture to the songs that again give it that sort of little lift.
Yeah.
I think of the song like Remedy, you know, that song you know that guitar line, but if you go back and listen to that song, one of the more, if you took out Eddie Harsh's, I think he's playing a Fender Rhodes.
Yes.
Maybe it's a Wurlitzer, but I'm pretty sure it's a Fender Rhodes. If you take out that electric piano, suddenly the song isn't that song anymore. But that's not the first thing you think of when you think of that song.
Yeah, it's just that extra little thing in there that creates, it really gets you thinking about all the different elements that make up things that go unnoticed, but are actually quite essential to its overall makeup.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this album needs more of that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a challenge when, the band is a three piece.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the challenge.
But then again, you know, think back to like the Cream albums or the Jimi Hendrix Experience. They never struggled with this.
No. I mean, and when, you know, when you're, well, that's true. But, you know, you can always bring in, if you're making a record, you can always bring in other musicians.
Yeah, this is,
you know,
this
you
is
don't
true.
Necessarily have to,
I don't think,
do
they
it
ever
exactly
did,
the
though.
Way you did it live. But, no, I don't think Jimi Hendrix Experience or Cream
No, I don't think anybody else did. The Power Trio was their thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm just saying it's doable.
Yeah.
Three people can make enough noise to actually make it interesting.
Yes.
Or in the White Stripes case or the Black Keys, two people.
Yeah. Two people, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the next song is called Kitchen. So let's hear it. Hopefully it continues down the same path.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more of what's going on in the second half.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
It's I'm sort of feeling a little bit like that song. They were throwing more elements in there. I like the guitar thing they were doing.
Yeah.
I thought it was kind of neat. The background vocals and the hand claps were giving it a little bit of an extra sort of texture, but I think they still buried that stuff a little bit too far in the mix.
Yeah. I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a little bit like that could have given it a little more presence. Like a lot of this stuff needs a lot more presence, like we've been saying before. But yeah.
But at least they're trying.
They are trying. They're putting stuff. And again, the songs themselves are still pretty high quality. I can tell that there's definitely a spark there, but they're not letting it turn into a flame.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. But I mean, this was one of the better songs on the album. I mean,
because it's an improvement over the first half.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And I think maybe as far as songs go, you know, it's hard to pick a favorite, but I think, this might be a favorite. This is one of the better ones anyway.
Yeah. I think Allison's Starting to Happen, as short as it was, is still probably my favorite on this one.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just the way they actually gave it the life that it so desperately needed. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it was just a decent song anyway. But I think, honestly, if the rest of the songs on this album were given the same treatment that one was, or a similar treatment, more accurately, almost every one of these songs could probably be as good.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe better. We'll see.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, I agree. So we've got three songs left. Well, two really, but the last one is a bonus track. So the next one, I just noticed the title. The next one is called "Ceiling Fan in My Spoon."
Ooh, now we're getting psychedelic.
There's a story behind that one.
Probably.
All right, here we go.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That one was again a lot more lively. The second half of this album was definitely, it's like a completely different animal than the other one.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. It's like I don't know if they recorded these in sequence. Probably not, but it's almost like, you know, they record the first half of the album and went, you know, I'm bored. We need something else in here.
Yeah.
And then they did.
Yeah.
But yeah, that song was like a punk track or something like that. It's the one that sounds the least in line with what everything else was, but you can still tell it's the same band.
Mm-hmm.
And that's honestly, that's a good thing.
Yeah. That's the mark of a good band. I mean,
yeah.
And it also, I mean, you know, I know we've criticized the production a lot on this, but basically
a lot.
But one thing that I can say is that the producers let this band be themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is, you know, 1992 and before things like Beat Detective and were to correct the timing of the instruments and auto-tune and all that kind of correction came in. But, you know, they're letting the band play the way that they play, which is, you know, I have to give the producers credit for that, because a lot of producers
won't do that.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is, if it's not my favorite song, it's at least my second favorite song. So
yeah.
Song 8, song 11, thumbs up for sure. And song 9's pretty good too.
Yeah. I remember, this is kind of a funny story. When I was going to school for audio engineering, I remember one of my teachers, he was like a young apprentice working with an engineer, and he went to him saying, because you know, on an acoustic guitar, you can especially hear when you're changing chords, you can hear the scrape of the fingers across the strings.
I sometimes really like that though.
And he was saying to this engineer, it's like, they were mixing. And it's like, I don't know how to get rid of that. And, the older, wiser engineer says, that's just part of the sound, man.
Yeah. It's the older, wiser. It's just like, why do you want to get rid of it?
Yeah.
Don't get rid of it.
Yeah.
Like, and I think we've talked about this before on the podcast. If not, I don't know if it was hidden on one of the ones that turned out weird. Anyway, when we were recording that, organist, we were going around from all these different churches all over the province, basically. And, we intentionally mic'd up things like inside the organ, because part of what he was trying to do was showcase these different organs.
Yeah.
He's playing these pieces. And again, it's mostly like classical and organ, you know, things, but we wanted to like showcase the organ itself. And some of that was like, you can hear some of the steam being generated or the mechanisms and valves opening and stuff like that. And we wanted to capture that. So we would actually point a microphone behind the rooms and stuff like that, as opposed to just like sticking out in the middle of the, which we definitely did too. Mm-hmm. We had microphones pointed at in all the conventional spots, but we wanted to make sure we could hear, you know, the machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was cool.
Yeah. And I remember setting up an omnidirectional microphone in the middle of the church, because I also wanted to capture what the organ sounded like in the room.
Right.
So I wanted to pick up the room tone as well. I wanted to record the whole thing.
Of course.
You know, I wanted to get the mechanics of it, and also the overall sound of what it, you know, what it feels like if you're actually sitting in the room with it. The other thing that teacher always said is, you know, there's all these, rules to mixing and to getting the best sound and to EQ and things. But one of the things that he said is, look, don't get caught up in doing things exactly the way you're supposed to do them.
Mm.
It, you know, and his thing is, if it sounds good, it is good.
Yep.
You know, if it sounds good, but you haven't, you know, EQ'd the drums the right way or something, like, don't just leave them alone. If it sounds good, it doesn't need to be done that way.
And one of my mottos is, you know, it's good to learn the rules, but it's nice to know the rules before you can break them.
Yeah.
And sometimes if you want to break the rules, it's okay to break the rules, but it is nice to know the rules that you're breaking.
Yeah.
So, that's how things progress. That's how things, you know, when you break a rule and it sounds good, it becomes a new rule.
Yeah.
So yeah, don't be afraid to break the rules. You're being an innovator.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What's the joke? It's like one wrong note is a mistake. Two wrong notes is jazz.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway, it could go the other way. Honestly, wrong note can probably sometimes be, you know, ignored as maybe being, oh, that's a neat little thing. More than one sometimes gets a little bit like, well, this guy sucks.
Yeah. Anyway, we've got this is the last song on the album proper.
Yeah.
This is called Frank Mills. Cool.
Yeah, that wasn't bad. And again, it was just him a foot tapping and then the acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was very effective.
Yeah.
I think a lot of these songs, again, the other thing you can do is strip them right down.
Yeah.
The song stands out more.
Yeah, I think if they had added anything else, it wouldn't have been as effective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Certainly if they had given it the same treatment as like the first half of this album, it would have been another song to ignore. Mm-hmm. But again, the songs on these are, these are good songs. These songs deserve better than what they got.
Yeah.
At least certainly the first half. Second half of this album is, the second half of this album is the album as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
Yeah. When you pick up this album, if you want to go and do that, yeah, tracks 8 through 12 seem to be
the highlights.
They're the highlights. That's the price that's what you're paying for.
Yeah.
For the most part. Again, the first songs are pretty they're decent songs. I just wish they got more attention.
Yeah.
They deserve better than they got. Yeah, that was a decent song. Sort of amusing and kind of sweet, I guess.
Mm-hmm. nice tribute to his friend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, I suppose after that, we can basically wrap it up with our, in quotations, bonus track.
It's the song
everybody knows.
Yes. I'm curious if this is the one. I wonder what movie this is from, because I'm pretty sure I've heard this before.
It used to be on the radio, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, this is a cover of Simon and Garfunkel's Mrs. Robinson. So I was just doing a little bit of reading of that. I thought that was a good cover.
The fact that it's a cover song is definitely, I mean, okay, it's a good showcase. Obviously that's different production.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that sounded way better. That's what I wanted to hear from the rest of this album.
Yeah.
So
apparently this was actually recorded for the 25th anniversary of The Graduate, which is Simon and Garfunkel wrote the soundtrack for that album.
Yes.
Or for that movie, and that this song was part of that.
Mm-hmm.
I was just reading about it though. And apparently Paul Simon absolutely hated this version and Art Garfunkel thought it was amazing.
Yeah.
And that says everything you need to know about Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah, pretty much. I think it was pretty good.
Yeah.
I definitely enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It's definitely a completely different animal than the original, though it's definitely recognizable as it. But yeah, like I was saying, that's the production I wanted to hear on the rest of this album. Like you can, this song is the way it's written. Honestly. I mean, when you hear the songs on the album, they sound like songs that are sort of written in the same sort of style. Like there's an interesting thing going along. They're not boring song. They're not boringly written songs. There's neat stuff going on. They needed that presence and the production that really showcased that band.
Mm-hmm.
That song showcased exactly what the band could have sounded like on the rest of this album.
Yeah.
Still, I would still say the second half of the album is
a vast
improvement over it.
Yeah.
But you can still sort of hear that same sort of core production, which still needed some improvement, but they were doing things that made up for it throughout the rest of the album. That song shows you just how good it could be.
You know, another something that just occurred to me that I never really considered is maybe like the second half of the album is what they recorded first and they were spending the time on, you know, doing stuff, but maybe they had a deadline and they just kind of rushed through it and said, well, we need to get this done.
Maybe. I would try to mix the songs up a little bit more in that case, because starting off as weak as the album did is not going to keep a lot of people listening. They'd be kind of disappointed. And by the time you reach track 8, you're If you reach it at all, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's a long way to wait before things start to really pick up.
Yeah.
And this is for a casual listener. If you're actually listening to the song itself, there's probably, I mean, there's enough, the songs contain, like I said, they're decent songs. They contain enough content to stand up on their own. Mm-hmm. I just don't like the way they were recorded.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, you don't get that kick in the face until the track 8 though.
Yeah. Which is, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty late in the album.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I pretty much agree, and I don't think I have anything more really to say about this.
No, I think we
pretty much
summed up our thoughts on the album.
Yeah. Well, so if you've made it this far, thank you for listening. You can check us out on you can send us an email at polyphonicpressmusic@gmail.com. We now have Instagram. I'm starting to get a little more active on Instagram as a way to sort of promote the show. I don't like Twitter because it's, I don't like Twitter. And,
I'm still on Twitter a little bit, but yeah,
you can follow us on Instagram, and you can, if you want to help out the show, you can do that by going to buymeacoffee.com/polyphonicpress, and you can check out the website polyphonicpress.com, and that's about it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.